We are, as we've done the last two or three weeks, talking about figures of speech. And I think one of the things we've seen is how prevalent all these kinds of figures of speech are throughout the Bible. I mean, they're used practically from Genesis 1 to Revelation 22. We've mentioned several so far, some very common ones, like simile and metaphor and allegory. We talked about metonymy and synecdoche. And tonight we're going to look at several different ones that certainly are used in a number of different places. This probably will not follow the one I gave you, but we'll try and cover as many of those as possible. Some of them are probably not on your list. I think I mentioned that the standard textbook on figures of speech is by a guy named E.W. Bullinger, who wrote it late 1800s, I think, something like that. And I don't remember how many hundred figures of speech there were, but it was just phenomenal. If you get a chance to ever look at that book, it's really amazing. A couple that kind of go together in a way are irony and sarcasm. And I want to look, they're both used in the Bible several places. Irony is a figure in which what is meant is the opposite of that which is stated. Really, one I really enjoy is found in the book of Job in chapter 12. Job chapter 12. Let's see. The first two verses. Remember, this isn't the part of the book where different friends, so-called, are there. And one in particular, Zophar, has been criticizing him for what he considers all the apparent sin in his life. Well, in Job chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, it says, "Then Job answered," in other words, Job answered Zophar as far as his accusations, "and said, 'No doubt you are the people, and wisdom will die with you.'" I love that. How might we say that same thing today? Obviously, there's a lot of variation in how we might say that today. What would be another way that we would respond to the critic like Job is responding, you know, several thousand years ago?
"You're the last Einstein."
Okay, you're the last. Oh, that's really good. "You're the last Einstein." Yeah. That's what he's saying, isn't it? "Oh, you know everything. Oh, well, boy, when you're gone, all knowledge is gone." You know. So, but what a way to say it. You know, Job could have said, "Well, you really don't know what you're talking about." But saying it like this really places a lot of emphasis on that. And I imagine Zophar will probably remembered it for some time, the way Job responded to him. And that's used in a lot of places. Let's look at some more. These, most of them are in the Old Testament. There's a few in the New. Let's go to Judges chapter 10. Judges chapter 10. And let's see. Well, to get the whole context, we probably need to look at a lot of the background. But this, of course, is in a section where, you know, in the Judges, that's where a judge comes along and delivers the people. Then they do well for a while. Then they fall back into sin. And then another judge has to come back. This one has to do with the children of Israel and the Baals, you know, the false gods. Verse 14 says, this is the Lord, Judges chapter 10, verse 14. This is the Lord speaking to the children of Israel. He tells them, "Go, Cry out to the gods which you've chosen. Let them deliver you in your time of distress. See, they had chosen all these false gods. So he says, well, I've been delivering you in these times with these different judges. So you go get some of those false gods and let them deliver you. Ironic, the way he put it. Another one in the Old Testament. 1 Kings 18. This is Elijah. He's on Mount Carmel. And he is basically in battle with all of the prophets of Baal. Verse 27 of 1 Kings 18 says this. Verse 27 of chapter 18. And so it was at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, cry aloud, for he's a god. Either he's meditating, or he's busy, or he's on a journey, or perhaps he's sleeping and must be awakened. He's making fun of them. He's mocking them. Remember, they're up on the trying to get their god to do something. And of course, since he's a false god, he can't do anything. So he starts mocking them. Oh, well, is your god asleep? Is he traveling somewhere and you can't get a hold of him? And he was making fun of them, basically. He was making fun of them. Pardon? Yeah, that's right. And so that's what he was doing. Now, a little different one is found in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians chapter 4. You know, the church in Corinth had lots of issues within the church. One of those issues was that some thought very highly of themselves. You know, some of them had spiritual gifts that other people didn't have, and so they were kind of proud of it and puffed up, which he mentions in the first part of 1 Corinthians chapter 4. Verse 8, he says, you're already full. You're already rich. You have reigned as kings without us, and indeed I could wish you did reign, that we also might reign with you. Now notice verse 14. I do not write these things to shame you, but as my beloved children, I warn you. See, he was shaming them by telling them that. They were proud and puffed up and arrogant because they had all these things, especially spiritual gifts. And so some thought they were better than others, and so they were proud and arrogant. And so he uses that to emphasize that they weren't full and they weren't rich. So again, using irony. And right along with that, sarcasm is used in a number of places in the Bible. Of course, teachers aren't allowed to use sarcasm anymore at school. Of course, that's sarcastic in and of itself, because I use sarcasm quite a bit. But anyway, sarcasm is used in the Bible, number of places. Here's how it's defined. A satirical remark is uttered with scorn or contempt, or a taunt, or a jibe, a cutting jest. Here are some. Let's look at two, both of them in two accounts of the gospel. First of all, Matthew 27. Matthew 27. Would someone read verse 29? Matthew 27, verse 29, and then we'll go to Mark 15.
When they had twisted the crown of thorns that fell on his head and a reed in his right hand, and they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, Hail, King of the Jews.
Yeah, they're being sarcastic, aren't they? They weren't bowing down to him as King of the Jews. They were making fun of him. Mark 15. Similar type of situation there. Mark 15, 31 and 32. Mark 15, verses 31 and 32.
Likewise also the chief priests mocking said among themselves with the scribes, he saved others, himself he cannot save. Let Christ, the King of Israel, descend now from the cross, that we may see and believe. And they that were crucified with him reviled him.
Here we see again the type of sarcasm that they're using is very cutting. In other words, it's They are mocking him, making fun of him. He claims to be able to save others. Why can't he save himself? And so they are using sarcasm when they're mocking him and making fun of him. And others could be used as well. But the Bible uses those a lot to emphasize a point, to help people remember what's said. You know, that phrase, "Hail, King of the Jews." That's just something that's kind of embedded in our minds, that phrase. Even though they didn't mean it, they meant just the opposite of it, but still, we remember it and why it was said. Hyperbole is a manifest and an expressive exaggeration for the purpose of expressing the full force and increasing the vividness of the subject presented. I was amazed when I started looking at this one how often this is used in the Bible. I mean, this is a very common figure of speech, is hyperbole. All right, let's go to Psalm 119, verse 136. Would someone read that, please? 136, Psalm 119, verse 136.
Rivers of waters run down mine eyes, because they keep not thy law.
Okay, rivers of water. Well, it's not a literal river, but what was he trying to say? Or what was he wanting to emphasize? That he was doing what?
Crying.
Crying and crying bunches, right? That's what he wanted to emphasize. That he was crying his eyes out, so to speak.
We might say today in buckets.
Yeah, crying buckets. That's how much he was crying. It wasn't just a few tears. But because the people were not keeping the law, obeying the law, observing the law, that was causing him to have these rivers of tears coming down his eyes. Great lesson there, I think. All right, Judges chapter 7. And when someone read verse 12, Judges 7, verse 12.
Now the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the sons of the east were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number, as numerous as the sand of the seashore.
Did they really have that many camels? No, but he was emphasizing that they had tons of camels, right? That's the expression he's using, just to show the vast numbers of camels that they had. And that's hyperbole. It's an exaggeration to make a point, to emphasize some detail. And in this case, it was the number of things. 2 Samuel chapter 1. Verse 23. 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 23. This is in a song. Verse 23 says, Saul and Jonathan were beloved and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Well, not literally. They couldn't fly or couldn't move faster than eagles, and they weren't stronger than lions. But he was emphasizing how fast and strong they were, and what a way to remember that. So again, that's why figures of speech are so often used in the Bible, to kind of drive home a point and show the detail. And in this case, it was their strength and their speed. Psalm 6:6. Well, this is another one about tears. Psalm 6:6. I'm weary with my groaning. All night I make my bed swim. I drench my couch with my tears. Well, see how vivid an expression that is? That again shows that he wasn't just shedding a few tears. This was just, they were just running out of him, just as fast as they could. And he had been doing it so long that it was on his couch. His couch was wet even from all the crying, him being weary. And then one in the New Testament, and then we'll move on to another one. John 21. It's the very last verse in John. John 21, verse 25.
And there are also many other things that Jesus did, which they were written one by one. I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that would be written.
That's a lot of books. But he was saying that what we have recorded here is just a tiny, tiny portion of the things that could have been recorded. So this isn't everything, what we have. We only have a tiny part of it. So many other things could be recorded. Talks he had with people, sermons he gave, miracles he performed, whatever. But regardless, there could have been so much more written. But this is what we have. And so again, a use of hyperbole.
But we have what we need.
Yeah, it's all we need. A lot of those other things would be nice. But
some that are saying yeah. That they're lost books.
Oh, yes. Oh, that's real popular now. The lost books of the Bible. Well, there aren't any. That would be a short book. If a book was written about the lost books of the Bible, it'd just open and be a blank page. There weren't any. But that doesn't sell. You know, if you put just blank pages in a book, it doesn't sell very well. But, you know, all this stuff, you know, of course, the Da Vinci Code and all that stuff is kind of the same type of thing. You know, more things revealed, allegedly, from secret papers and secret documents or secret books. But again, it sells. Yes?
Instead of the Da Vinci Code, if people would just pay attention to the prophecies and trace them out, do a whole lot more good.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Good point. Yeah. But that would take a lot more time than reading the book or seeing the movie. So, yeah. So that's what, you know, that's more entertaining. You know, to think that there's some lost books of the Bible. Oh, there's a lot of things that have been kept from people. You know, someone has hidden it or this group has had secret knowledge over the years. That just appeals to people. And so, you know, the more books and movies and stuff that are written about that, I imagine that stuff will just keep being sold. I mean, I really do. I don't think there'll be any stopping that. I think it'll just be more and more popular. All right. I think we have time, maybe for one more. Anthropomorphism. It's a figure which describes human features or elements of the human form to God. Let's just look at a couple, and that'll be about all the time I think we have tonight. Exodus 33. Exodus 33, verses 22 and 23. Exodus 33, verses 22 and 23. So it shall be, this is God talking to Moses, while my glory passes by, that I will put you in the cleft of the rock, and will cover you with my hand while I pass by, then I'll take away my hand, and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen. Now, the Bible says that God's a spirit, so therefore he doesn't have a physical face, a physical hand, a physical back. But those characteristics are applied to God, first of all, to help Moses understand, but then later us to understand as well. And so he uses that figure of speech to give God those type of features. Even though God doesn't have a physical body with those physical things, those features are given to God to describe what is happening, to help Moses at least understand, and then us later on as well. Another one, 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 12, and that's about all we'll have time for tonight. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 12. Of course, this is quoting from the Old Testament. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 12 says, "For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayers, but the face of the Lord is against those who do evil." And again, God doesn't have physical eyes or ears or face, but this helps emphasize that what? God sees everything that's going on. He knows, hears everything that's going on. And he will take judgment against those who are not righteous. So we still have several more figures of speech. Lord willing, we'll look at those next Wednesday evening.